Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is a catastrophic defeat for this government. After 2 years of failed negotiations, the House of Commons has delivered its verdict on her Brexit deal, and that verdict is absolutely decisive.
The British Parliament rejects Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan and the worst defeat in British history. Will she survive today's no-confidence vote? We'll speak to British economic journalist Paul Mason, then to the confirmation hearings for Attorney General nominee William Barr.
I believe it is in the best interest of everyone, the President, Congress, and the American people, that this matter be resolved by allowing the special counsel to complete his work. The country needs a credible resolution to these issues.
William Barr vows to let Robert Mueller finish his probe into Russian meddling, but says Mueller's report may never be made public. During the hearing, he was also asked about the jailing of journalists.
As a last resort, and where a news organization has run through a red flag or something like that, knows that they're putting out stuff that will hurt the country, there could be a situation where someone would be held in contempt.
We'll speak to the ACLU's David Cole and Kristen Clark of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the worst defeat for a ruling government in British history, Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal to withdraw Britain from the European Union was crushed Tuesday by 230 votes. John Barkow, the Speaker of the UK House of Commons, called the roll.
Order! The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock! On a point of, indeed, point of order, the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how. Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold. And people, particularly EU citizens who've made their home here, and UK citizens living in the EU, deserve clarity on these questions as soon as possible.
Britain is scheduled to leave the European Union in 10 weeks, but the rejection of the deal leaves uncertainty about what will happen next. Shortly after Tuesday's vote, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn called for a vote of no confidence in May's government to be held within 24 hours outside the Parliament. Supporters of a second referendum on Brexit cheered Tuesday's outcome. This is anti-Brexit activist Rebecca Ireland.
I'm very happy. This is a first step. We need to have a people's vote. There needs to be a choice on the ballot paper between Remain in the EU and Theresa May's deal.
After headlines, we'll go to London to speak with journalist Paul Mason about Brexit. The White House Council of Economic Advisers has doubled its estimate of how much the shutdown is likely to cost the economy, with many independent economists warning it could push the U.S. into a recession. The warning came as President Trump ordered nearly 50,000 furloughed federal employees to return to their jobs without pay as the longest government shutdown in U.S. history entered its 26th day with no end in sight. Among those ordered back to work are food safety inspectors, aviation safety workers, IRS employees who'll process income tax refunds. On Tuesday, a federal judge rejected a lawsuit brought by unions that would have required the government immediately pay workers who are required to work. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked a Senate vote on a House-approved bill to reopen the federal government. It was the second time McConnell has blocked a vote on ending the shutdown. Meanwhile, President Trump invited a handful of rank-and-file Democrats to the White House us for a working lunch aimed at winning support for Trump's border wall, but not a single Democrat showed up. Meanwhile, the shutdown continues to wreak havoc on the basic functions of U.S. government. Native American communities are reporting shortages of medicine as the Indian Health Service goes understaffed, while a federally funded food delivery program to Indian reservations has halted. Immigration courts have seen 20,000 cases per week added to an already record-high backlog, and the Transportation Security Administration says a man with a loaded pistol passed through airport security at Atlanta International Airport. TSA workers are being forced to work without pay, and hundreds have been calling in sick as the shutdown drags on. A federal judge in New York City barred the Trump administration Tuesday from placing a citizenship question on the 2020 census, setting up a likely battle over the issue at the Supreme Court. Voting rights activists say the citizenship question is aimed at deterring immigrants from participating in the census, leading to a vast undercount in states with large immigrant communities, impacting everything from the redrawing of congressional maps to the allocation of federal funding. We'll have more on the 2020 census later in the broadcast. Senate confirmation hearings began Tuesday for William Barr, President Trump's nominee for attorney general, to replace Jeff Sessions, who was fired in November. Barr served as attorney general for George H.W. Bush from 1991 to 1993, but senators asked few questions about his past record while focusing heavily on his views about special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Barr vowed to allow Mueller to complete the probe, but suggested Mueller's long-awaited report might not be made public. He also defended writing an unsolicited memo last year to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, in which he criticized Mueller's investigation. We'll have much more on William Barr's confirmation hearings after headlines. In Kenya, armed men burst into an upscale hotel complex in the capital, Nairobi, Tuesday, killing 14 people and launching a hostage crisis that stretched on for nearly a day. The Somali-based militant group al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. In 2013, a similar assault by al-Shabaab killed at least 67 people at a Nairobi shopping mall. Last year, the Trump administration targeted al-Shabaab with an unprecedented number of airstrikes across Somalia. Former Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto accepted a $100 million bribe from drug traffickers. That's according to a witness who testified Tuesday at the trial of the notorious Mexican drug lord known as El Chapo here in New York City. The allegation came as a former associate of El Chapo, the Colombian drug lord Alex Cifuentes Villa, took the witness stand in a federal district court in Brooklyn. Peña Nieto has not responded to the claim, but has previously denied charges of corruption. At The Hague, former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo was acquitted Tuesday of crimes against humanity and will be set free by the International Criminal Court. Gbagbo faced charges of responsibility for the violence that killed more than 3,000 people after he refused to relinquish the presidency, despite losing elections in 2010. He was the first former head of state to stand trial at the ICC. His acquittal follows similar failures of prosecutors to win convictions against other African leaders in recent years. In Brazil, newly inaugurated far-right President Jair Bolsonaro signed a decree Tuesday making it easier for people to keep guns at home. Critics say the move will worsen Brazil's murder rate, already one of the highest in the world, with more than 60,000 homicides per year. The World Food Program has cut aid to Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza, citing a critical lack of funds. The WFP said this week more than 25,000 Palestinians will no longer receive aid. A further 165,000 Palestinians will see their food aid slashed by 20%. Last year, the Trump administration eliminated more than $500 million aid to the Palestinians. Aid groups are warning further planned cuts threaten new projects, including a playground for Gaza children and new infrastructure to provide clean water to Gaza homes. The House of Representatives voted 424-1 Tuesday to condemn white nationalism and white supremacy in a rebuke to Iowa Republican Congressmember Steve King. The vote came after King told the New York Times in an interview published last week, "White nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive?" he asked. Tuesday's vote was not a formal censure of Steve King, who's made similar remarks throughout his 16-year career in Congress. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, Democratic Socialist Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said Tuesday it's time for Democrats to embrace a marginal tax rate of 70% on the wealthiest earners. Ocasio-Cortez says revenue from shifting the tax burden onto those who can most afford to pay could fund progressive legislation like universal health care or a Green New Deal. Speaking to The Hill Tuesday, Ocasio-Cortez cited new polling data showing majority of Americans support the idea.
I don't think it's a case that I have to make because it's a case that the majority of Americans have already made. This is a policy that is already popular, and it's time that we embrace working Americans, and it's time that the Democratic Party fights in a full-throated manner for the working class in the United States. And to not support a marginal tax rate is to really just allow runaway wealth inequality to persist.
New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said Tuesday she's joining the race for the presidency in 2020. Gillibrand made her announcement on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Well, I'm going to run for president of the United States because as a young mom, I'm going to fight for other people's kids as hard as I would fight for my own, which is why I believe that health care should be a right and not a privilege.
Senator Gillibrand's aides say she'll run on a platform supporting a Medicare for All health care plan. She's also pledged to fight for universal paid family leave and publicly funded federal elections. She was appointed as New York's junior senator in 2009 after Hillary Clinton left the post to become Secretary of State. Gillibrand since won two elections to retain her seat. She joined Congress as a conservative so-called Blue Dog Democrat with a favorable rating from the National Rifle Association, but has since backed progressive legislation, including the Green New Deal. In Russia, LGBTQ activists are warning of a new crackdown on gays and lesbians, with at least 40 people arrested in December and reports of two people who were tortured to death. Chechen officials have denied the reports, which are based on interviews of victims by the Associated Press and other outlets. In 2017, human rights groups said as many as 100 people, mainly gay young men, were swept up by police and tortured in what was labeled a gay pogrom carried out by Chechen officials. Second Lady of the United States Karen Pence is working at a Virginia private school that explicitly bans LGBTQ workers and students. Pence started work this week at the Emmanuel Christian School in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, where an employment application requires job applicants to pledge not to engage in homosexual activity or to violate the, quote, unique roles of male and female, unquote. The application also advises women that, quote, a wife is commanded to submit to her husband as the church submits to Christ, unquote. And New York State lawmakers have approved a pair of bills aimed at protecting the LGBTQ community. One bill bans licensed mental health professionals from participating in so-called conversion therapy, a pseudoscientific practice that seeks to coerce queer youth into renouncing their sexuality. A second bill expands hate crimes to include attacks motivated by gender identity or expression. David Kilnick, president of the LGBT Network, said, quote, banning the harmful practice of conversion therapy will save lives. New York has sent an important message to the rest of the nation today that no matter who sits in the White House, progress in the fight for equality and justice will move forward, unquote. But some trans advocates are objecting to New York's expansion of the definition of hate crimes. Chase Strangio of the ACLU argues hate crimes laws disproportionately target communities of color and could even be used to enhance sentences for trans and queer people convicted of what the FBI calls anti-heterosexual hate crimes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in the United Kingdom, where Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal was crushed Tuesday in the biggest defeat for a sitting British government in modern history. After months of buildup, May's plan for withdrawing Britain from the European Union was voted down 432 to 202. Fomenting political uncertainty about the future of Britain, as well as May's leadership. John Bercow, the Speaker of the UK House of Commons, called the roll.
Eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432.
The eyes to the right, 202. The nose.
The
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock! On a point of, indeed, point of order, the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how... Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold. And people, particularly EU citizens who've made their home here, and UK citizens living in the EU, deserve clarity on these questions as soon as possible.
The UK is scheduled to leave the European Union in 10 weeks, but the rejection of the Brexit deal leaves ambiguity about what'll happen next. Shortly after Tuesday's vote, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed Parliament, calling for a vote of no confidence today in Theresa May's government.
The result of tonight's vote is the greatest defeat for a government since the 1920s in this House. This is a catastrophic defeat for this government. After 2 years of failed negotiations, the House of Commons has delivered its verdict on her Brexit deal, and that verdict is absolutely decisive. I therefore, Mr. Speaker, inform you I have now tabled a motion of no confidence in this government. Will be debated tomorrow, so this House can give its verdict on the sheer incompetence of this government and pass that motion of no confidence in the government.
That was Tuesday. Today, Labour leader Corbyn said he misspoke when he called the vote the largest defeat since the 1920s, saying, in fact, it's the largest defeat in the UK's democratic history. Parliament is currently debating Corbyn's no-confidence motion and will vote at 2 p.m. Eastern time today. The future of Britain's relationship with the European Union hangs in the balance. If May's government survives a no-confidence vote, it will have the option of introducing a milder Brexit deal or proposing a new Brexit referendum altogether. If the no-confidence vote passes, it could trigger a general election. 71 later Labour members of Parliament have signed a public statement calling for a new Brexit referendum, arguing a Brexit renegotiation, which Jeremy Corbyn has been pushing for, is unrealistic. Their statement said, quote, no deal would be a catastrophe which we must resolutely oppose. Meanwhile, The Guardian reports Theresa May has not invited Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn to cross-party Brexit talks, despite her epic defeat on Tuesday. Well, for more, we go to London, where we're joined by Paul Mason, New Statesman contributing writer, author and filmmaker. His latest piece for the New Statesman is headlined, "To Avoid a Disastrous Failure, Labour Must Now Have the Courage to Fight for Remain." Mason's most recent book is titled Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. Paul Mason, welcome back to Democracy Now! Now, please explain what happened. If you could explain, Paul, just exactly what happened yesterday, how historic this vote was. I think you're having trouble hearing me. We're going to go to break, and then we're going to come back with Paul Mason in London talking about this historic Brexit defeat. Stay with us.
To let me know, should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine, the next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go decision's bugging me.
Decision may molest
you. If you don't want me, set me free. Exactly whom I'm supposed to be.
Should I stay or should I go? The Clash here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined now by Paul Mason, New Statesman contributing writer, author and filmmaker. His latest piece for The New Statesman, to avoid a disastrous failure, labor must now have the courage to fight for remain. So Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal was crushed in the biggest defeat for a sitting British government in history. Why do you think the deal was rejected, Paul, and the significance of what is now taking place, the debate over no confidence?
Well, Amy, just let me just put this into context for American viewers. Imagine Trump said, let's leave NAFTA. Okay, the right of American politics would applaud. But if he said, well, we're leaving NAFTA, but we're following NAFTA's rules, so Canada and Mexico get to determine America's trade policy, there'd be uproar on both sides of your House of Representatives. And that's effectively what happened last night in British politics. The far right of the Tory party and all the other progressive parties combined together to defeat May. So 230 out of a 650 parliament, that was the margin. And it leaves her not only facing the worst defeat a government's ever faced, but this is the only piece of legislation her government was elected to do. It is a one-trick pony, and the trick just failed. So that's why she's facing now the vote of no confidence. I don't think, unfortunately, Jeremy Corbyn is going to be able to defeat her tonight, because those self-same right-wingers who voted against the deal have no interest in putting Corbyn into power. So we've got a government that needs to fall but cannot fall.
For people who don't exactly understand what Brexit is, please explain.
The way it goes now is that if Corbyn were able to win a vote of no confidence against Theresa May, there would have to be a general election. Now, that's something that it's not only, you know, politically unpalatable to the right and, of course, the corporate elite here in Britain, but this crisis we're living through here in Britain with Brexit is the end point of a 40-year period of neoliberal economics. It's become very focused, as it has in your country, on xenophobia, white nationalism, free trade. All these themes are there. And basically, the corporate elite cannot afford to see this Tory government fall when the only alternative is the most radical and most left-wing Labour Party we've ever had. And so that's why you've got this complete stasis and paralysis in British politics. And of course, we're not the only players here. We're dealing with a continent with 500 million citizens, Europe, which is waiting for an answer. And the press here in Europe, you know, we've been awake for 4 or 5 hours now on this side of the Atlantic, is appalled by what has happened. We've got one of the most powerful governments in the world, a key NATO ally, just in chaos.
Interesting you mentioned NATO, because new discussion is taking place in the United States about revelations that President Trump has repeatedly wanted to pull the United States out of NATO.
Yeah, and look, here in Europe, the far right are being heavily, heavily funded and promoted by Vladimir Putin. At the same time, you know, I think America is by many people now looked at as an unreliable ally because of these revelations about Trump. My opposition to Brexit is not simple. And there are many of us on the left of the Labour Party who, yes, of course, we want to go to the extra mile to try and honour that referendum. But if it cannot be honoured, if it just cannot be done without destroying the country, we're not going to do it. But not just for economic reasons, because we need, in a very unstable world, we need to create alliances here on the continent of Europe that ensure stability and the rule of law and democracy. In Poland, only 2 days ago, the mayor of a major city was murdered. You know, we have political violence now in our continent, and we want to calm things down. And we want to be able to do it, of course, in a way that speaks to those poor communities that are being dragged towards the right, dragged towards this right-wing populist xenophobic politics. But we cannot really do it by abandoning our values. Mm. And you know what? We've been very... You mentioned in your headlines, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We on this side are very inspired by AOC, as she's called, because here we see a left politician fighting from the heart with values. And we want to be doing some of that. And I personally, you know, want to get this Brexit thing concluded. I want to get rid of this Theresa May government. But Brexit concluded because we need to try and win back some of those dislocated communities, the ex-industrial communities. We need to do it from the heart, not with technocratic language and parliamentary manoeuvring.
You mentioned the murder of the Gdansk mayor. His dear friend, the European Council President Donald Tusk, seemed to urge Britain to cancel Brexit in a tweet Tuesday that read, "If a deal is impossible and no one wants no deal, then who will finally have the courage to say what the only positive solution is?" Paul Mason.
Well, look, the problem we have here on the left of politics, you know, we are in some ways similar to the Democrats in America, but in one way we are not. Hillary Clinton used to be accused of being the Wall Street candidate. We have no support amongst our own corporate elite. What we achieve in the British labour movement will be achieved with working class and lower middle class votes only. And so our electoral alliance will never be with our Wall Street, the City of London. It will always be, let me put it this way, an alliance between Brooklyn, Chicago and West Virginia. Those kinds of demographics. And so we have to keep West Virginia, our equivalent of it, in our alliance. Now, that's quite hard when they voted to leave Europe.
Paul Mason, I'm going to interrupt
because what they're now learning is that there's no form of Brexit that's going to help them. And I think that's where we are. Sorry.
Jeremy Corbyn is speaking right now, and we want to go to the floor of Parliament to hear what he's saying.
9 years. Our NHS is in crisis. Waiting time targets at accident emergency. I'm talking about waiting times at accident emergency departments and for cancer patients that have not been met since 2015. And they've never been met under the government of this Prime Minister. Not yet. The NHS has endured the longest funding squeeze in its history, leaving it short-staffed to the tune of 100,000. And NHS trusts and providers in over $1 billion in deficit. The human consequences are clear. Life expectancy is now going backwards in the poorest parts of our country.
Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, in his arguments for a no-confidence vote, for a vote of no confidence for Theresa May. Clearly, this goes beyond Brexit, as he's talking about the National Health Service and just the state of Britain today, Paul Mason.
Well, what Corbyn was talking about there, of course, is our free at the point of use healthcare system. And it's being destroyed by austerity, by government spending cuts. Now, we know, because we are out there on the doorstep of working class communities, that one of the things that drove some of them to support Brexit was the idea that in a world of limited resources, then we don't want to share those resources with migrant people who come from Europe. This is the xenophobic argument. And so what Corbyn is doing there, he's turning the argument back to where the real blame is. The blame is that we bailed the banks out with the money of the taxpayer, and the taxpayer therefore had to make a choice, bail the banks or fund the healthcare system. That is the argument that we in the labour movement and the trade union movement are having every day of the week to try and bring back, because we're determined not to abandon these blue-collar, you know, Rust Belt-type communities to far-right politics. We're going to win them back. So that's what Corbyn's trying to do there, and link the severe social dislocation and poverty in Britain to the non-answer of Brexit.
Could we see British Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, Paul?
Yes, and you could see it within 2 weeks if he wins one of these votes. He's going to move this no-confidence motion. You can move one any day of the week. So if he loses tonight, he can wait and do it again. In the interim, we're going to see the middle of Parliament, the centre in both parties, try to cobble together some solution. They may do it. But the problem is then that has to go back to a negotiation with Brussels, and Brussels will only negotiate with the government. It can't negotiate with Parliament. So ultimately, everything, every solution leads to a new election. And in that election, it'll be very hard fought because we've already got Steve Bannon's money, you know, pouring into British politics. The dark, opaque money of Russia and the money of people like Bannon is out there. And they're going to try and fund the same thing they funded in your country. But we have one thing. We have a mass active party of progressive and left-wing people, and we're going to fight for the soul of Britain if that election comes.
What do you mean the money of Bannon?
Well, look, Bannon in Europe has been trying to set up a cross-national, a multinational movement of European right-wing parties that wants to change European politics in the coming European parliamentary election. Now, there probably won't be a European parliamentary election in the United Kingdom, but we're hearing all kinds of things about Bannon, Farage, who was the leader of this far-right party, UKIP, and now some people like Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is a right-wing member of the Conservative Party, but interestingly, in Parliament this week, he, for the first time, used the words deep state. So he's saying the deep state is stopping Brexit. Now, where does that rhetoric come from? It's the rhetoric of Bannon. It is the rhetoric of the alt-right in America. And, you know, on our social media, not so much in our civil society face-to-face, but on our social media, my goodness, we are inundated with the fake news and the rhetoric of the Breitbarts and those info wars. It's all over the British social media. And that's what's going to be unleashed if there's a new Brexit referendum.
Hmm. What is happening now with Ireland? How is this being viewed in Ireland and Northern Ireland?
Okay, hopefully some of your viewers know that the United Kingdom is the United Kingdom of Britain and Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland is a six-county enclave which was separated off from the rest of Ireland after a civil war, and it itself has a big religious divide. Now, the Catholic community in Northern Ireland does not send its MPs, by and large, to Parliament. Sinn Féin, which largely represents the anti-unionist community, the Catholics, does not come to Parliament. It boycotts Parliament. The unionist part of that society is represented by a religious right party called the DUP. Now, they hold the balance of power. Theresa May doesn't have a majority in the British Parliament. She only has a majority with this right evangelical Christian type party, the DUP. Now, they're backing her. They're backing her, even though they didn't support last night's deal. And that's the paradox. They, too, cannot afford a progressive government because they have this very, very sweetheart kind of deal with the Conservatives, an extra £1 billion whenever they want it, just to keep Theresa May in power. So, but Ireland, as a state, one of the 27 states of the European Union, of course, the Republic of Ireland is a very successful, modernised, liberal, small capitalist country. And they're just looking across the Irish Sea at us, and I think just in despair. Because we are destroying, not just destroying our reputation, we're actually destroying our own democracy. We have allowed the dark money into our democracy. And, you know, outside here, behind me, you can see Parliament. The biggest problem right now is politicians trying to cross the street with people in, you know, the Trump Make America Great hats, literally those red hats, chasing them and shouting all kind of fascist rhetoric at them. And, you know, this is a new phenomenon in British politics. The sudden eruption of kind of weird harassment tactics against politicians. And the Irish are looking at that and saying, you know, how did that happen? Because you're supposed to be one of the richest and most successful and powerful countries in the world.
Do you think there needs to be a new referendum, Paul?
I would, because the alternatives are a softer form of Brexit is going to get through Parliament behind me. And I'm not so much in favour of that. And I think that we can't stop Brexit without a referendum because the legitimacy of that first referendum has to be cancelled out by another one. But Jeremy Corbyn is playing very clever here because he has to be seen to go to the hilt, to the final mile of trying to make the old referendum, i.e. Brexit, work to soften it, to make it more palatable, to make it less damaging for working people and their families. That's what he's trying to do now. That's the phase we're in. And I agree with that. The argument comes inside the Labour movement. You know, we're going to have to take with us a lot of progressive people, young people, people of colour, and most of them want a second referendum. We also have to take the working class communities of small industrial towns, and a lot of them wanted Brexit. And as I said before, we don't have a Wall Street supporting kind of faction in our left. We just have the working class. So we have to, as it were, keep both halves of it together. And so if we end up with a second referendum, that's got to be fought as a class struggle and not as some kind of huge kind of fanfare for how great Europe is. Europe is a neoliberal construct. It is a right-wing construct. We happen to be in it. Leaving it is worse, but being in it is also not great. So you can imagine that the communication challenge that creates for Corbyn, but he's the only person who could have done it. All the other people, the predecessors, the centrists, the kind of weak, kind of bland, classic, middle-of-the-road, centre-left politician, would be at sea by now. And yet, as you saw there in the Commons, Corbyn is commanding the situation. And that's why people like me have supported him and continue to support him to the hilt.
Paul Mason, I want to thank you for being with us. New Statesman contributing writer, author, filmmaker. His latest piece for The Statesman, To Avoid a Disastrous Failure, Labour Must Now Have the Courage to Fight for Remain. Mason's most recent book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. This is Democracy Now! Of course, we'll continue to cover this and the no confidence vote in Theresa May. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the William Barr Attorney General confirmation hearings. Stay with us. Nothing even matters, Lauren Hill, here on Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Senate confirmation hearings began Tuesday for William Barr, President Trump's nominee for attorney general to replace Jeff Sessions, who was fired in November. Barr served as attorney general for George H.W. Bush from 91 to 93. During that time, he was involved in the pardon of six Reagan officials for the Iran-Contra scandal and oversaw the opening of the Guantanamo Bay military prison, which was initially used to indefinitely detain Haitian asylum seekers from Haiti. Barr also openly backed mass incarceration at home and helped develop a secret Drug Enforcement Administration program, which became a blueprint for the National Security Agency's mass phone surveillance effort. He went on to work as general counsel for Verizon. But on Tuesday, senators asked few questions about Barr's past record while focusing heavily on his views about special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Barr vowed to allow Mueller to complete his probe.
When is your Jim Mattis moment, when the president has asked you to do something which you think is inconsistent with your oath? Doesn't that give you some pause as you embark on this journey?
It might give me pause if I was 45 or 50 years old, but it doesn't give me pause right now, because I had a very good life. I have a very good life. I love it. But I also want to help in this circumstance, and I am not going to do anything that I think is wrong, and I will not be bullied into doing anything I think is wrong.
That was Senator Dick Durbin questioning William Barr. Now let's go back to William Barr.
I believe it is in the best interest of everyone, the president, Congress, and the American people, that this matter be resolved by allowing the special counsel to complete his work. The country needs a credible resolution to these issues. And if confirmed, I will not permit partisan politics, personal interests, or any other improper consideration to interfere with this or any other investigation. I will follow the special counsel regulations scrupulously and in good faith, and on my watch, Bob will be allowed to finish his work.
Well, Attorney General nominee William Barr vowed to let the Mueller probe continue. He didn't promise to make Mueller's report public. He also defended writing an unsolicited memo last year to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in which he criticized Mueller's investigation. Attorney General nominee William Barr was also asked about President Trump's call to build a wall along the southern border.
As been pointed out earlier, it is the major avenue by which drugs come into the country. Heroin, fentanyl, all the serious drugs are coming across that border. And again, I feel it is a critical part of border security that we need to have barriers on the border. We need a barrier system on the border. To get control over the border.
During his confirmation hearing, William Barr was also asked about press freedom by Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota.
My dad was a reporter, so I grew up knowing the importance of a free press. We obviously have the tragic case of a journalist who worked right here at the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi, and it's a particular concern. So I want to ask you something I ask Attorney General Sessions. If you're confirmed, will the Justice Department jail reporters for doing their jobs?
I think that, I know there are guidelines in place, and I can conceive of situations where, as a last resort and where a news organization has run through a red flag or something like that, knows that they're putting out stuff that will hurt the country. There could be a situation where someone would be held in contempt.
To talk more about William Barr's confirmation hearing, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Kristen Clark is with us, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Here in New York, David Cole, national legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center. His recent article for the ACLU is headlined, "No Relief, William Barr is as bad as Jeff Sessions, if not worse." Let's begin with you, David Cole. Did these hearings confirm your conclusion for them about that?
Well, they certainly didn't negate our concerns. This is somebody who has a long record. A day of telling senators what they want to hear doesn't refute the long record. And that long record includes arguing that Roe versus Wade should be overturned, the most important right for women across this country.
When did he argue that?
1991, when he was up for his first attorney general proceeding. He defended President Trump's Muslim ban. He pushed for, as attorney general, more incarceration. When people were criticizing the system of mass incarceration, he put out a report called The Case for More Incarceration. He said, the truth is we need to lock up more people, not fewer. And he said in the hearings yesterday that his views have evolved, but there's no evidence of that. He has praised all of what Jeff Sessions did on criminal justice reform, which was to essentially reverse the efforts of Eric Holder and the Obama administration to try to reduce the harshness of the criminal justice system. He, Barr, opposed sentencing reform that would reduce the harshness of federal criminal sentences. On national security and surveillance, as you indicated in the opening, he introduced what was essentially the blueprint for the bulk collection of Americans' phone records, at that point focused on drug enforcement, but still focused on massive numbers of people with no suspicion. He argued there's no constitutional objection to doing that. And, of course, he has an extraordinarily broad understanding of executive power. And so while he says, I'm not going to improperly interfere with the Mueller investigation, I will scrupulously follow the regulations. The key is when he says executive privilege or executive power has been interfered with by what Mueller has done, Then he can say, well, I'm not now improperly interfering with the investigation. I'm doing it on the basis of my view of executive power. And he has an expansive view of executive power. So I think there are grave concerns about this nominee.
Mm-hmm. And why worse than Sessions?
Worse than Sessions, you know, it's hard. It's a low bar, worse than Sessions, right? But worse than Sessions in this sense, he's probably a better administrator of the Justice Department than Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions started out as a lawyer, but spent his entire career basically as a politician, not as an administrator of the Justice Department. Bill Barr has been a lawyer his entire career, has already been the Attorney General of the United States, knows how that system works, and I think will be very effective at using that system to advance the anti-civil rights agenda of this administration.
Mm-hmm. And his saying, yeah, no, I'm going to let this continue, the Mueller probe continue. In fact, he said, you know, the Muellers and the Barrs are close friends and we go way back. But this issue of rewriting the report.
Yeah, so the report, technically the special counsel's report under the statute goes to the Justice Department, not to Congress, not to the American people. And then the Justice Department reviews it, and if there is privileged material in it, it will excise that material and then issue something to the American public. But, of course, what the American public sees, what we see, will depend on the expansiveness of whoever is in that office, their view of executive privilege. And he has very, very broad views of executive privilege. So I think you might see a report that is essentially one of those, like one of those Freedom of Information Act documents where, you know, half of the page is blocked out and then there's a sentence and then the next half of the page is blocked out. And so, we'll see. But when you're putting somebody in this office who has a very, very broad view of executive privilege, and it's going to be his job to say what the American public can know about this report, very, very troubled.
I want to turn to an interesting moment with Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas questioning William Barr.
Thinking back to James Comey's press conference of July the 7th, 2016, where he took the step of talking about the evidence against Mrs. Clinton, talking about the legal standard that would apply as to whether she might or might not be indicted for committing a crime under the Espionage Act. Have you ever seen a situation where an FBI director would usurp the authority of the Department of Justice to make that charging decision and hold a press conference and talk about all of the derogatory information that the investigation had gleaned against a potential defendant and then say, now we're not going to, no reasonable prosecutor would indict her? Have you ever seen anything like that happen before?
No, I've never seen that, and I thought it was a little bit, more than a little bit. It was weird at the time. Jim Comey is a, as I've said, is a extremely gifted man who's served the country with distinction in many roles. But I thought that to the extent he actually announced a decision was wrong. And the other thing is, if you're not going to indict someone, then you don't stand up there and unload negative information about the person. That's not the way the Department of Justice does business.
I want to bring Kristen Clark into this conversation, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Kristen, this interesting conversation, a lot of Democrats might have been saying, oh, that's Senator Cornyn saying it was very inappropriate for Comey to announce that he was investigating Hillary Clinton. But I think the overall message from this, when Barr was saying, yes, it was inappropriate, and that he shouldn't have made this public, that if there aren't charges, you don't unload information. Is he saying the same thing about Mueller's probe if he doesn't bring charges against the president of the United States?
You know, it's unclear, but I will say from having been in the room for the hearing for the duration of the day that many of the senators, I think, went to great lengths to understand how Mr. Barr would handle this investigation if he is confirmed.
at the end of the day. And I think that the verdict is out. He did express some bare commitment to, allowing Mr. Mueller to see his investigation through. But whether there would be a change in the rules or policies that ultimately prohibit Barr from disclosing the contents of the report to the public, and whether he would resist efforts mask or fail to disclose to the public the contents of Mr. Mueller's report, I think remains to be seen. That said, I do think that one of the most important areas for the Senate to probe here is Mr. Barr's civil rights record. As we've talked about, what we have is his record and what he did during his former tenure as Attorney General. And one of the starkest things that stands out is indeed this book, this kind of government Bible, if you will, that laid bare the framework for mass incarceration in our country. The report is called The Case for More Incarceration. And there, Barr unabashedly made the case for mass prison construction. He talked about how to fund mass prison construction. He endorses harsh sentences. And even since he's left the Attorney General, we've seen consistency in his approach when it comes to race and criminal justice.
Well, let me go to this very point. It was when the New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker was questioning William Barr.
During your previous tenure as Attorney General, you literally wrote the book on mass incarceration, or at least wrote this report, The Case for More Incarceration. You argue that we as a nation were, quote, incarcerating too few criminals.
In those days.
And that the solution was more incarceration for more people.
Excuse me.
Please, sir.
For chronic violent offenders and gun offenders.
Well, I mean, that's the challenge, sir. And you argued against the bipartisan legislation in 2015 quite strenuously.
I did.
But that's not that's not the nature of incarceration in this country. In fiscal year 2016, only 7.7% of the federal prison population was convicted of violent crimes. Overwhelmingly, what was initiated in those times that led to an 800% increase in the federal prison population, overwhelmingly, that was nonviolent drug offenders. Except right now, our federal prison population is overwhelmingly nonviolent. 47.5% of the federal prison population are incarcerated for drug offenses. And I guess hearing your arguments then and hearing your arguments against the bipartisan legislation that we brought out of the committee in 2016.
Senator, I think that's wrong, what you just said, okay? I think when you have violent gangs in the city, killing people, murder and so forth and so on, sometimes the most readily provable charge is their drug trafficking offenses, rather than proving culpability of the whole gang for murder. So you can take out a gang on drug offenses, and you could be taking out a lot of violent offenders. Do you think that the murders in Chicago are they're related to gangs,
and
including
again,
gangs involved in
and
these
sir,
guns?
And again,
William Barr being questioned by Senator Booker and Kristen Clark.
You know, there is an encouraging bipartisan movement underway for criminal justice reform in our country, and William Barr is an outlier when you think about efforts now underway to reform our criminal justice system. His ideas, his way of thinking are outdated. They're from a bygone era. And what I was looking for yesterday was for Mr. Barr to unequivocally disavow the views outlined in that 1992 report, the call for more incarceration. I was looking for him to distance himself from his work with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, where he advocated for more tougher sentences and for more prison construction. I was looking for him to distance himself from the work that he did in Virginia, where he worked to abolish parole. I was looking for him to distance himself from an op-ed that he wrote recently in The Washington Post, where he condemned efforts under President Obama to address the need for policing reform in our country. I think with William Barr, we're going to get somebody who will only wreak further havoc when it comes to criminal justice reform. We talked about what happened during Sessions' tenure and all of the ways in which Sessions worked to reverse the course of progress that we've made when it comes to criminal justice. He issued a directive instructing prosecutors to impose harsh sentences. He reversed a directive that would have phased out the use of private prisons. And I fear that with Barr, we will see this Justice Department doubling down in ways that will cause great harm to communities, but especially to communities of color. You know, yesterday marked the 90th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. And by no means are these ordinary times in our country. We've seen congressional leaders having to take the extraordinary step of issuing a resolution to condemn white supremacy in the country because we have a sitting member of Congress who espouses views and seems to embrace white nationalism. We're dealing with hate crimes. We're dealing with a police shooting crisis. We need an attorney general who will not stay the course, but will come in and undo all the damage that occurred during the Sessions era, and most importantly, confront all of the grave civil rights and racial justice problems that we're confronting in the country right now. And I'm not sure that William Barr is the one up for that most important task.
I want to turn now to the latest news of a federal judge in New York City barring the Trump administration Tuesday from placing a citizenship question on the 2020 census, setting up a likely battle over the issue with the Supreme Court. Voting rights activists saying the citizenship question is aimed at deterring immigrants from participating in the census, leading to a vast undercount in states with large immigrant communities, impacting everything from the redrawing of congressional maps to the allocation of federal funding. David Cole, the ACLU brought this case.
Yeah, we brought this case because it was clear to us that what Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, who made this decision, wanted to do was to undercount those parts of the country where there are significant immigrant populations, which happen to be overwhelmingly Hispanic, which happen to be overwhelmingly urban, which happen to be largely Democratic. And he sought to do it by putting a citizenship question on the census, notwithstanding the fact that for the last 70 years, the Census Bureau has been unanimous that it is a disaster to put such a question on the census because it deters people from answering the census.
And he lied about putting it on.
And knowing that that was not a permissible reason to do it, he concocted a false reason, that is that the Department of Justice needed this information to enforce the Voting Rights Act. The notion that this Justice Department is interested in enforcing the Voting Rights Act is a joke to begin with. But secondly, the Justice Department has never sought this information to enforce the Voting Rights Act under any administration. But he finally prevailed upon Jeff Sessions, personal call to Jeff Sessions, to get the DOJ to write a letter in which they appeared to be asking for what Wilbur Ross, in fact, initiated. And then he concocted a record that sought to conceal that. And so yesterday, a federal judge here in New York issued a 277-page opinion after a three-week trial, finding a veritable cornucopia of legal violations by Wilbur Ross and the Commerce Department in seeking to conceal the real reason why they're trying to distort the census.
And clearly this will go to the Supreme Court, the Kavanaugh Supreme Court. How do you think they will rule?
Well, I think, you know, you've got a very extensive set of factual findings by this district court, 277 pages. He's the one who heard the testimony. That makes it much more difficult for the court to overturn it. But also, at the end of the day, this is about democracy. Democracy turns on knowing who lives where so that we know who should be representing them. And so I think every member of the court ought to be interested in an accurate census.
Well, I want to thank David Cole of the ACLU and Kristen Clark of Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.